Well, good morning, sister. I'm all wired up, ready to go. So we're beginning this retreat by looking at what we need to be doing constantly and forever, really, this side of the grave, to clear the way for prayer, for communion with God, for grace to spring up within us. And yesterday we looked at obedience and love, and this morning I'm going to look at detachment and humility. So let's see what some of the things St. John of the Cross has to say about detachment first. In his ascent, he writes, "The only desire that God permits in his dwelling place," that's you and me, "is the desire to carry out his will perfectly and to carry the cross." Life provides the cross. I don't think we look for it. Jesus didn't, so I don't see why we should. But life provides it, and when we have it, we either carry it or don't carry it. And he's saying, carry it. In The Dark Night, he writes, "We need a remarkably vigilant care and interior determination concerning what to do and what not to do in order to please God." So if we want communion with God, if we want what Jesus said he came to give us, to live and live to the full, which is allowing the divine energy and love to come through us and transform us, well, then we need a remarkably vigilant care and interior determination, focus. I mentioned yesterday, I mentioned it again, in The Dark Night and in The Ascent, he has this image of a bird wanting to fly, but it's attached to the branch. And his point is that no matter how slight the attachment, still can't fly. So we actually have to break all attachments. We'll qualify that in a moment, because we only are going to break the ones that God directs us to break, but still we need to be ready to break anything. Our desires are to be directed towards God through love. All our energy is to be directed to the glory of God, seeking to do God's will in all things. St. Ignatius of Loyola, not to do things for the glory of God, but for the greater glory of God. Well, let's have a look at some of the attachments that will be attaching us. And I'll look first at the attachments at the level of feeling. And in his ascent, John writes, "Seeking oneself in God is something entirely contrary to love." Seeking oneself in God is the same as looking for God's consolations. Another way of putting that may be, you know how the difference is between loving someone and loving the feeling of loving them. They're both healthy human things, but they're not the same thing. So seeking, this must be something that we all are involved in, seeking oneself in God, seeking to feel close to God. And it's the feeling we want, not God, but the feeling of being close. or whatever words you could put on that better than that. We're actually seeking something for ourselves in loving another person or in loving God. And John is warning us against that. Just love the other for the other. Feelings will come and they're fine, but we don't seek them. Now this next one, the ascent, I even thought of skipping this, and then I thought, no, I got no right to skip it. I'm trying to present John of the Cross. This seems a bit tough to me, but who cares what I think? Maybe that's because I need to hear it. So I'll read it as it stands, and it's very demanding, but so is love and so is life, so I'll read it. John says in his ascent, I'd like to offer a norm for discerning when gratification of the senses is beneficial and when it's not. And here's his advice to us. Whenever upon hearing music or other things, seeing agreeable objects, smelling sweet fragrance, feeling the delight of certain tastes and delicate touches, whenever you immediately at the first movement direct your thought and the affections of your will to God, receiving more satisfaction in the thought of God than in the sensed object that caused it, and whenever you find no gratification in the senses except for this motive, it's a sign that you're profiting by the senses and that the sensory part is a help to the spirit. The senses can then be used because the objects sensed serve the purpose for which God created them, that God be more known and loved through them. My one little extra thought, and I dare to throw in an extra thought to John of the Cross, so forgive me. As long as we realise, I think this is true, if we think of a sensory experience with a person or with music, he says, or opera, it could be anything, something that's delighting you. If we think of that and we think, no, that's only good so long as my first movement is towards God, and notice my gestures, that God, then I think we're missing the whole point, I think, of what John's trying to say, I presume. Because God is not other than the music. God is beyond it, of course, and the music isn't God, you know. But it's not too directional here. Finding God, I understand, to be the penetrating the actual experience to the heart, not going somewhere else in preference. I don't ask you to agree with me, and I'm probably wrong, but I mean, is it at least making sense? That God is found at the heart. So our life is not about, and the whole thing of detachment is not about detaching from this to go over there, but detaching from staying on the surface rather than penetrating. So it's a movement into the heart of the beauty, creation, the heavens, the cosmos, another human being or whatever. I hope John forgives me if I'm wrong, but you will, I know, so. What about other attachments that we can have? Not at the level of feeling now, but at the level of thinking. In his ascent, John says, all that can be grasped by the intellect, I guess that's what we're trying to do this week, partly, would serve as an obstacle rather than a means if a person were to become attached to it. So if you become attached, or I, to our idea of God, that will stop us coming to know God, because God is way beyond any theology. If we become attached to a certain point of view on anything, it will become an obstacle, like a barrier to God, because God is always drawing us through our thoughts, through our feelings, through our understandings, beyond them. So we have to be free to fly, not to be attached to the branch that we like, that's made sense to us. We can even be attached, I'm sure you know this, to past graces. John of the Cross, in his Ascent, talks about past graces as being steps on a ladder. So the past grace that you received back in the novitiate, when you're in the flight of absolute sanctity and you leapt into your vows with great delight because of these wonderful experiences you were all having, and as I look at you, I can tell you all had them, or whatever it might be, a retreat you made 3 years ago, or a special movement of prayer that left you kind of wondering and stunned. We'd all like, I presume you're the same as me, we'd all like to go back and have that again, because it did, we were close to God. You can't, you shouldn't. And I shouldn't be wanting that grace back there, I should be wanting God here. So, again, value, and it's good to remember, of course, but we can't go back and we can't be attached to the grace. We can only be free to go to God, who's beyond every grace. Let me read from the Living Flame. You should not bear being attached to anything, whether it be the practice of meditation, or to anything, whether sensory or spiritual, which delights you. He doesn't say don't be delighted in it. Don't be attached to what delights you, or any way of thinking. You should be very free regarding everything, because any thought or discursive reflection or satisfaction upon which you may want to lean would impede and disquiet you and make noise in the profound silence of your senses and spirit, which you possess for the sake of a deep and delicate listening. We're back to obedience. A listening. Where is God now wanting to love you is the only real question. And being attentive to that is the only real response. Helped by the memories, drawing on the graces of the past, but not being distracted from this moment by them. Because if you're distracted from this moment, you're distracted from God. Again, the Living Flame. Detach your senses, and by that he means feelings and all that, from everything, which is all you yourself have to do. That's all you've got to do, detach yourself from them. All you've got to do. Apart from a simple, loving attentiveness. You shouldn't use any force except to detach the soul and liberate it so as not to alter its peace and tranquility. So don't, he's saying, don't push. People keep saying, well, I'll try. And I must say, I keep saying to them, for God's sake, that's the worst thing you could do. Don't try, just do it. Because try has a bit of a you know, energy and impulse and determination. No. Attach yourself to God now and to the moment, and you will be detached from the others. In his final paragraph of the first book of the Ascent, John writes, in self-dispossession the heart is at rest. It wants nothing because it's grounded on Jesus, not on itself. It doesn't matter whether it feels elated or dejected. If any of us found any of this easy, we'd be missing the point. It's not about easy or hard. But he's saying whether you feel elated or dejected is irrelevant. That'll depend on a whole lot of things that you have no control over. But just want communion with God and listen, attentiveness. John does in a few places, but in The Dark Night he talks about a log of wood that you put on the fire, you know, and it hisses and blackens and goes through a whole lot, and eventually it's just pure coals, just glorious red. But there's a process of tss and blackening on the way. Now, since you're obviously enjoying this topic so much, let's have a look at the asceticism is different for absolutely everybody. We've all got a different journey. God knows what each needs to let go to draw closer to Jesus and to enjoy divine communion. So God knows what you need to do and what I need to do. For the rich young man, he had to let go material possessions, and you know the story. But that doesn't mean you have to. For the scribes, it was their pride in their learning. They knew the Bible off by heart, back to front, perhaps literally. They had it back to front. But anyhow, they stuck to that. For others, it was their negative sense of themselves. For others, it was their inflated ego. Some of us might have an inflated ego, and some of us mightn't have one at all, and we need one. Essential to asceticism is that we're not the ones to decide. We've got to wait on the inspiration of grace, because what we want to do, back to yesterday evening, is God's will. God will tell me and you where he wants to draw us. And if we're coming to Jesus, well, some will come from the north, some from the east, some from the south, and some from the west. And we'll be doing contrary things because we're coming from a different place. So what is God asking in this retreat? What is God asking you or me to let go so that we can be drawn into communion with Jesus and so with God? I gave the image yesterday, so I won't read that there, of Peter in the boat. That's a beauty image from the gospel. Peter doesn't sit in the boat and think, now I've got to leave the boat, I've got to detach myself from the boat, or I'll never get to Jesus. Had he thought that, he would never have got out of the boat. He looked at Jesus, and remember his words, he said, if you call me, if... Jesus may have said, no, I don't want to call you now, you're right, I'd like you to just stay in the boat and row, for God's sake, because the others depend on you to row. Okay, so he rows, Butte may get there. Now, Jesus, if you call me, I'll come to you, and I'll come to you across anything. And Jesus says, come. So he leaves the boat. I'm sure you'll follow the logic. Leaving the boat is not the point. It's responding to the call, the present call. There's a beautiful, well, I love it anyhow, little icon or picture of Jesus on the cross and Mary and the beloved disciple. It's like a dance, really, and it's full of love, isn't it? So imagine what that meant to Jesus and how that supported him in his prayer to have these two beautiful people, brokenhearted, but there with him. She wanted to be there and get him off. Of course, every mother would. But whatever their feelings, there's love there, and that's how Jesus knows God loves him, through people. Well, Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, you must deny yourself. And the self is the self we're trying to talk about in this first part of this meditation. It's the self that's not open to love. The purpose of detachment is that we might be free to make a wholehearted gift of ourselves to God. Here's a beautiful statement. It's actually from the Psalm, Psalm 40, but the author of the letter to the Hebrews applies it to Jesus at the Incarnation. When Christ came into the world, says this beautiful writer, we don't know who he is, it's fine. When Christ came into the world, he said, and here's the quote, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you take no pleasure." Then I said, this is Jesus, "My God, I've come to do your will." Because Jesus knew that God's will is what will liberate him to live to the full. And it will liberate us. So any self that's holding me back from that is what we have to deny and say no to. On this Feast of the Assumption, it's worth again looking at Mary. As a young woman, Mary knew that left to herself, there's no way she could carry out the mission revealed to her by God. And I can't and you can't, left to ourselves. Fortunately, we're not left to ourselves. God was offering her an unprecedented intimacy. Keep remembering when you read the story of the Incarnation that the angel of the Lord, see, we've got this problem too. We think there's God, and then there's an angel called Gabriel. And God's too busy to come himself, so he sends his angel, Gabriel, to tell Mary. And Mary would say, "Well, what are you doing here? If God wants to talk to me, why doesn't he come?" You know what I mean? We get all confused in all this stuff. The angel of the Lord is God. That's what God means in biblical tradition. The angel of the Lord is the appeared, it's God himself. Well, Gabriel is the stage person for this. But it's God saying to her, "I love you, I want to enter you, I want you." And Mary says to God, "Well, how can I do this?" He says, "I've got no man, I've got no..." And God says, "Okay, darling." He says, "I'll come upon you." Very sexual image, but it meant to be that too. "And I'll breathe my breath into you." I'm not asking you to... "I'll do it." "Wow," says Mary. And then she just says, "Well, okay, go for it. Let what you've said be done to me. Love me. You want to love me? Well, fine, here I am. Love me." And he loves life into her. So she's just asked to say yes, really. But she says yes. To be so open, to allow God to achieve his loving purpose in us, we need to hold everything that is not God so reverently that we're willing to let it go the moment God calls us to do so. So could I put it this way? I think this is true, and you'll know if it's not. Detachment doesn't mean you're not attached. If you're not attached to anyone or attached to anything, if you're not connected to anything, well, you're dead. You look pretty good to me, so I think you must be. So we're supposed to be attached. Detachment is the virtue of being willing to let go what we're attached to when love calls us to take another step. We eventually got to let go of life, which, thank God, we're attached to, I presume. But we've got to let it go finally, and we've got to let a lot go. Parents sometimes have to let their children go, for God's sake. How they do it, I don't know. And relationships break down. We know all that. So Therese of Lisieux, I reckon, has the best image. She says, "I want to go to God with open hands." So there's things in your hand, but they're not held in such a way that you can't be tugged away from them by love. So it's enjoyed, attached, communicated, connected, going to the heart, all of that, but free when love, only when love, no other reason, calls you, you go beyond or you penetrate further in, perhaps a better word. Now, I've got rather a long quote, because I think it's a good one, by a Carthusian, and he doesn't give his name. I suppose a humble thing to do. It's a beautiful book, though. It's called The Way of Silent Love. And I'll just read it to you. I hope I won't butt in and comment, but it's 3 pages, so just see if you enjoy it or see if it speaks to you. There's no peace without detachment. There's no detachment without effective renunciation. There it is, he says, the hard saying. Our passions carry us towards what is pleasing and delightful, towards what we love. Thus, they cause us to avoid what is unpleasant and hurtful, the things we fear or hate. The way of resurrection is the way of death, a curtailment of life, a mortification of the senses, etc. Today, he says, as always, we don't want it. But listen to Christ. If anyone would follow me, let her deny herself and take up her cross and follow me. There is, says this author, Carthusian, there is no other way. In speaking, he goes on, this is so good, in speaking of detachment, I'm afraid of giving too much importance to what is of little consequence. Certainly, detachment from things is an essential element of the spiritual life. But this doesn't mean that we're obligated to make a continual effort of the will to be detached. A continual preoccupation such as this is unhealthy and sometimes results in a negative attitude and bitterness that has little to do with Christian simplicity and joy. In the end, it puts too much emphasis on secondary matters. To be continually preoccupied with denying ourselves something is to feed the desire to possess and give it importance. Brackets, so I would suggest that you might like to put in there the image of Peter in the boat. He's looking not at himself and what he needs to get rid of. He's looking at Jesus and what his deepest longing wants. But he's not going to let that deep longing go because of something he's attached to. You've got it? It's the longing that's the matter. Anyhow, this man continues, and I'll conclude with this here. The true contemplative doesn't need to make a constant effort to mortify the senses. Only love is necessary. The heart turned to God and the things of God. Or rather, he realizes that things are leaving him and detaching themselves from him. Life does that. He quickly forgets them. So fascinated is he with the discovery of the wondrous mystery. Let us not be like the fearful people who on the mountain didn't take their eyes from their feet for fear of stumbling. Though for some of us that's not a bad idea. But you'd get the image anyhow. So just picture yourself when we're all a bit more lithe. All right. Let's not be like the fearful people who on the mountain didn't take their eyes from their feet for fear of stumbling, and thus were unable to revel in the broad horizon and the vast expanses. Let's be bold enough to be joyful, he says. The love of God, Christ and the love of God, are worth it. And I'll conclude my little tiny reflection on detachment with the words of Teresa in her poetry, little poem she wrote. Let nothing disturb you. Let nothing frighten you. Everything is passing. God alone does not change. Patience obtains everything. The one who clings to God wants for nothing, for God alone is enough. So is my tiny contribution to this idea of detachment. I suppose for me the most helpful image is to realize that detachment is a penetration rather than a looking elsewhere. It's a going deeper. It's loving more, not stopping loving so that you can love God. It's actually a letting go of anything that stops us penetrating to the heart of the world and creation and people and our own heart. Where, because God is the heart and the beyond of everything. And now for the second half of this little meeting, I'll talk about something that I know a lot about. Humility. That wasn't such a good start, was it? Okay. John of the Cross, Dark Night. Spiritual humility is opposed to the first of the capital vices. Capitals like the hinge of the door. So, spiritual pride, the worst thing we can have, and this is the exact opposite of it. Though this humility, acquired by means of self, through this humility, I beg your pardon, acquired by means of self-knowledge, a person is purged of all those imperfections of the vice of pride into which she fell in the time of her prosperity. Aware of her own dryness and wretchedness, the thought of her being more advanced than others doesn't even begin to occur as it did previously. On the contrary, she realizes how better others are. Or again, if I could dare to improve on John of the Cross, I'd say the comparison isn't relevant. You know, people don't have to be better or worse. It's just, you're just you. Is a rose better than a lily? Is a lily better than a rose? Go out into the garden. I don't know if there's one here. I haven't looked well enough. I'm not very sensate. But a massive big oak tree, and then down on the little path there's a tiny little purple, what do you call those little purple flowers on the...
Violet,
that's it. Violet flower, right. So you've got a map, and the violet flower that's being... All it gets is slug slime every now and then, and somebody treads on it, poor little thing on the side of the road, and it looks at this wonderful big oak tree and it thinks, God, I'd love to be an oak tree. I'd love to be as holy as Mother Mary Aikenhead. She founded some order. What was it?
Charities.
None of you here, are there?
Yes.
Oh, beautiful. Well, darling, this is for you. So I'd love to be as holy as Mother Mary Aikenhead. Oh, I'd love to be like John of the Cross. Or wouldn't it be good to be an oak tree up there away from all these bloody little things and you can give shade and you can, you know, birds can land and you can have nests and it can be full of life. It'd be wonderful to be like that. In the meantime, the oak tree is looking down at this violet and thinking, God, I'm a colourless blooming thing and I've got horses rubbing up against me and I've got bird poop all over it and I've got broken branches and every time the wind comes it snaps a branch off, whereas this little Violet down there is just comfortable and tucked in at the side and is having a glorious life. I wish I was like a Violet. So here we are, we're all wishing we were like somebody else. Well, it's wonderful, sister, the only one you can be like is you. And I can only be me. So let's get to know who we are, and that's okay. It's good to be you. It's the best thing you can possibly be. To be humble, says John of the Cross again in one of his councils, is to hide in your own nothingness and to know how to abandon yourself to God. Now, nothingness doesn't mean you're nothing. It means that you, or me, on our own, wouldn't be here. Where the breath of the Spirit of God breathed us into being through our mother and father's love, of course, mediated through that. And here we are held in existence by God. If God took his hands away, you know that image in the beginning of the Bible that talks about God made us from the, wait for it, afar, the dust of the earth. Well, if we were made of clay, someone could make you and put you on a mantelpiece and you could be there in 1,000 years' time, probably. A bit of, because it's solid. But if you're made of dust and you've got an artist forming you out of dust, you got any idea what would happen if he took his hands away? So we're held in existence by love all the time. So of ourself we're nothing, but we're not of ourself. We've got this life coming through us. So humility helps us realise that. In the interior castle, let's look at Teresa of Avila. She says, set your eyes on Christ. This is the way. There you will learn true humility. Self-knowledge gained in this way will not make you cowardly. And in her Way of Perfection, she writes, humility, however deep it is, this is so important, isn't it? Neither disquiets nor disturbs the soul. Sometimes we might have been trained by ill-advised people who were doing their best to a false kind of humility. Putting yourself down, well, putting yourself down is not humility, you know that. And wanting others to put you down is not humility. Humility is always accompanied by peace, joy, and tranquility. Although we're distressed by our sinfulness, yes, this distress is accompanied by an interior peace and joy of which we should not like to be deprived. Far from disturbing or depressing the soul, it enlarges it and makes it fit to serve God better. She's a wise girl, isn't she? Distress can disturb and upset the mind and trouble the soul. When you find yourselves in this state, she gives this advice. If you find that you're so distressed about yourself, she says, well, look, stop thinking about yourself. Stop it. And you're think of the mercy of God and God's love and suffering for us. So if thinking of yourself is starting to depress you, have a look outside and look at Jesus. Don't go down that track. I quoted earlier for you from a book called The Courage to Pray by Anthony Bloom. And I think this is really nice. In his book he writes, the word humility comes from humus. What's our other word for it?
Compost.
But the humus is the word we're there. Okay. Fertile soil, humus is, capable of making good use of the rubbish we tip into it. Capable of transforming our refuse into wealth. Accepting every seed, like the rich silent, creative earth, we should offer ourselves to the other. An attitude of self-surrender, which is at the same time extremely active. It's self-surrender because, like the earth, humus, we give ourselves without reserve. It's active because we're ready to respond to God's every suggestion and every call. So I think to be humble, it means to be simply yourself and grateful to be yourself. And along with that will come, as we've already heard, recognition of your failings, of your sinfulness, of your attachments and all that kind of thing. And they need working on, but they don't come in to disturb the recognition that being yourself is the best thing you can be. Because, well, who are you? Let's have a bit of a look at some of that. Humility requires self-knowledge. And, these are my words, but I've taken them from wherever I've read them, and I'm sure it's true. You don't come to know yourself by looking at yourself. Think about it and check whether it's right, true or not, but I think it is. You don't see yourself by looking in a mirror. You see yourself by looking in the eyes of someone who loves you. That's how little babies know who they are, by their parents just wasting time loving them. Wasting time, you know, I've got the inverted commas. They're just, God help us, what's going on through that long gaze that's happening for hours and hours and hours from mum and dad to the child. The child is learning who I am. They're not capable of reflection. And it's the same with teenagers, and that's why they fall in love, because somebody sees something in them that gives them great joy, bubbles them over. And it's the same with us. We learn to see ourselves as God sees us, as another, the other, sees us. Now this requires contemplation. There's that lovely image, I find it lovely, I read it years ago in a book called The Agony and the Ecstasy it's on the life of Michelangelo, the name of the author escapes me, but you might recall Michelangelo in one of the yards, I guess you'd call it that, in Firenze, Florence. There was this bit of Carrara marble that had been cut off the mountain, beautiful, pure white marble, but it had been broken, or it had come off at an edge. And apparently he wasn't the only great sculptor in that part of the world. No one could do anything with it because of its shape. It kind of twisted halfway down. And the story is that he used to look at it and look at it and look at it and look at it, till one day he saw in the marble David. And then he just chipped away so he could reveal one of the great masterpieces of the world, which if you look at it carefully, it's twisted at the hips and it's all quite... But here it is. And isn't that what you do with children? Isn't that what you do as a teacher or a nursing person? Or isn't that what we do when we love someone? We contemplate them and we see things that they don't see. Because how can they see it? You need a lover to see it. So loving is a very contemplative thing. Well, God loves you, so God sees you, and God is the one who calls you beyond an attachment that you now have to a deeper loving, or God is the one who shows you who you really are. Humility is an attitude of mind and heart learned from Jesus. and inspired into you and me by the Spirit of Jesus, whereby a person recognizes him or herself as God's child, sharing the life of God's Son, and living in total dependence on God's loving providence. A humble person delights in this dependence. Remember the, well, you might know, a little story of Thérèse of Lisieux when she was a tiny little girl and her dad was at the top of the staircase and she wanted to go up to him but she couldn't lift a foot high enough to get up the step to go to Dad, whom she had an immense love for. And so what happens? Dad walks down the stairs and picks her up and carries her up. So and that's great. She just wanted to be with her dad. She didn't want to be able to climb up on her own. And as long as he kept. So it's the same with us. We're dependent on God, and that's a good thing to be. It's the real me that God is calling into prayer. So we're getting close to ending this now. That's the real me. The real me precisely as I am now. It's not the me that I used to be. It's not the me that I'd like to be. It's not the me that others think I should be. We can easily get caught up in all of these. But that's not who I am. This is who I am now, wherever I am. The real me is the one that God is drawing into deeper communion with himself today. Of course, if I respond to this grace, I won't remain the same. How could such a love enter my life without changing me? But it is the real me here and now who's being invited into this intimacy with God. This is a very consoling truth, I think. We don't have to be different to attract God's attention. And we live in a culture which wouldn't believe that, you know, not just of God, but of anything. People have to be fatter, thinner, taller, shorter to be attractive, you know, don't they? Isn't that what the whole advertising thing's built around? So we have to be different to be attractive. Well, God says, no, you don't. We don't have to earn God's love. And whatever mess I might be in now, God wants to love me here and now. And when we doubt this, which we do, we can. We've got the prodigal son, Mary of Magdala, the thief on the cross, the leper, and all the characters of the gospel to say, stop thinking like that. Jesus wanted to love Mary of Magdala and the leper and the thief now as they are. And the love would be to transform them into what God wanted them to be. So, just a reminder of who you are, who I am. I'm a creature held in existence by the love of God, my Creator. It's a good start. I'm someone dear to the heart of Jesus. Because he believes in me, I can learn to believe in myself. And I can learn to believe in the designs that God has for me. Jesus' love for me encourages me to dare to live. And we remember Jesus' words, if you love me, keep my word, and my Father will love you and will come to you and make our home in you. So I'm a creature of the Father, I'm dear to the heart of Jesus, and I'm a temple of the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit that we're talking about is the communion that Jesus had in prayer with God. That's the Spirit. That Spirit. And that's the Spirit that was poured into our hearts. once again, a brief look at the icon there of the Trinity. And each of us is invited into communion there, to be part of the dance. The key to discovering how I can love is found in being attentive to the actual ways in which God has graced me in my life. And during a retreat, it'd be good to remember those. And to actual ways that I'm wounded by sin, and it'd be good to remember those too. The real me. We must never, while we're doing this, remembering grace and remembering sin, we must never lose sight of our own mystery or the mystery of another. We cannot fathom our own being, so don't try, because we cannot fathom God. If we fail to respect the mystery of the sacred, we are, as Anthony Bloom observes, like a person digging to find the source of a spring, the point where the water begins, the point just before which there's no water. And if we're digging like that, all we'll do is destroy. We won't discover. So we have to let the spring well up, trusting it's there, and just gently but determinedly clear the way. Genuine humility flows from a consistent commitment to the truth. Good to ask yourself how committed you are to the truth. I used to think I was, and I think I am in a way, but I did discover to my shock 20 or so years ago that yes, I am committed to the truth, and everyone else would think I was too, and I really work hard at it. But I found, and you know, this is a bit personal, but you know, you can put up with this, I'm sure, that I was committed to something a bit more. And it's a matter of temperament, I think. I actually like liking people and like being liked. So that's actually more basic to me than the truth, which I didn't think it was, but it is. It was, anyhow. And can you see how that tricks you up? If you want to be liked and want to like people more than the truth, then you can find that you can, without even realizing, you can be fudging with the truth to make someone happy, to feel good, to make the community really restful and good. And you know what I mean? You're not actually, and I've learned in my head, and I think I've learned a bit of it, no, we have to be committed to the truth first. Paul puts it perfectly. Do the truth in love. So you do the truth with yourself and with others and with the community and with the church and with everything. Do what's true as best you can, and humbly, of course, and not pretending you've got the lot. But if something appears to you or me to be true, do it, and do it as lovingly as you can. But don't not do it in the name of love, because it's not real love. And actually, as religious, we can be pretty poor at this. I think my married brothers get a fair bit of truth from their wife and from their teenage kids when they were teenagers. They don't get away with much because there's always somebody there, right or wrong, to face them up, isn't there? Isn't that how it works? Whereas in a religious congregation, as a priest or a sister or a brother or whatever, we can dance around things, say, oh, sorry, you know, the dear little thing, it's okay. And we can not correct or not confront or not say or not be real, because we're all being holy. Well, I've said enough, I think. So it's this commitment to the truth. It's, well, Paul, I can't do better than that. Do the truth. Now do it with all the love of your heart. But do it. Genuine humility comes from a consistent commitment to the truth, especially the truth of God seen in the light of the revelation of Jesus, and the truth of oneself seen in the light of faith, not seen in any other way, but in the light of faith. God will always offer us his love, but God can do so only to the level of our humility. Otherwise, we would be in danger of the worst evil, distorting grace. God can't afford to give you grace to do something beautiful if when you do the beautiful, you take the pride in it yourself. Do you see what's happening? It's hurting you and it's hurting others. So God has to hold back grace because he's putting it in a place that's only going to cause harm. God can absolutely grace Mary with all the love and grace of God because it's all going to be good, because it's all going to be my Magnificat, you know, not me. So I'll conclude with the image of Jesus, which you've seen before, and the text that's there looking at you. And if we want to learn any virtue, we have to look at Jesus, because he shows us what they really are. And this is one here. Come to me, all you who labour and are overburdened, and I'll give you rest. Learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your soul.